This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to What If Malaysia, an 8-episode miniseries where we explore what Malaysia could look like with certain progressive ideas, concepts and policies. I'm Darshan Johan, and on our first episode, we ask, what if Malaysia has a woman prime minister? But I can't do this alone. So joining me on the show today is Melinda Ann of the 111 Initiative, which is an initiative that aims to ensure that there is 50% female representation in Dewan Rakyat. Welcome to the show, Melinda. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Darshan. This is such an exciting series.
Yes, and I'm very, very excited to do this first episode with you. Before we talk about what Malaysia could look like with a woman prime minister, let's take a look at where we are today. We've had 8 prime ministers to this date, none of whom were or are women. We've had one woman deputy prime minister, which is Dr. Wan Azizah, but even that was rather short-lived. But what about women in politics in general? How are we doing in that regard, Melinda?
Like you rightly pointed out, it did seem like we were making progress, but obviously with the change in government, we significantly declined. So during PH time, we did see our first female deputy prime minister, and there were also more women representation in other government agencies, including the judiciary, which still has a good proportion of women. However, when we're looking at the whole like country as a whole, we only have 33 out of 222 parliamentarians who are women, and only 5 women among 31 ministers. And if you're looking at PN now, it's funny because someone actually called it a bloated federal cabinet, but there is a distinct decrease in women's leadership in PN. None of the 4 senior ministers appointed in the place of a deputy prime minister in PN is a woman. And you're telling me that there are no qualified women in PN, that you actually had to elect Shahidan Kasim to be on the Parliamentary Select Committee of Women and Children Affairs. We're not doing so great now.
But in this regard, right, when we're talking about the lack of women in politics, Malaysia isn't necessarily an anomaly in the world in this matter, right? Because the number of women who are heads of government or national parliamentarians are few and far between, no matter where we look.
Yep. I mean, I was at the Beijing Plus 25 Asia Pacific Review in Bangkok in 2019. And during the ministerial conference, many countries' representatives across Asia and Pacific were speaking about the improvements they made in terms of women's political participation in their own countries. And we actually had our Secretary General of KPWKM speak about improvements during PH time. So that was basically a review to see how we're doing since the Beijing Platform for Action 25 years later. And there have been improvements, but of course, we're nowhere close to the 30% minimum threshold, because I think in our region itself, the women's participation in the lower house, or Dewan Rakyat in Malaysia, is actually just 20%, when the global average is 25%. And we're nowhere close to the minimum threshold of 30%. There are certain countries in Asia Pacific that are doing better, but I mean, we are actually third from bottom in ASEAN. So there are countries doing much better than us.
But why do you think this is? Why is there still a lack of women representation in politics?
I think we've been having a lot of conversations on this, especially like with you know, discussions on women's political participation and all that. And I could see the most obvious being the nature and processes of political parties and the general political climate. Because if you see, the process is very opaque, like how nomination is done and all that. And we all can see that majority of parties are men, right? It's male dominated. Mm-hmm. And obviously the nomination process, as most people call it, are controlled by male gatekeepers. So it makes it difficult for women in parties to actually climb that ladder and occupy decision-making spaces. And
What do you mean by protected by male gatekeepers?
It's because primarily the decision-making positions are held by men.
Okay.
So this brings me to my next point of actually the electoral system in Malaysia. In Malaysia, we follow the first-past-the-post electoral system, which means the constituencies are divided among members of coalition, which means there are limited number of constituencies, which means limited number of candidates to be fielded. So when it comes to fielding this limited number of candidates, because there are more men in these parties, men tend to be the ones to be nominated for these positions. So because of a general lack of number of women, there are lesser chances of them to occupy these spaces.
But why is the current status quo a problem?
It's a problem because it retains the notion of where women belong. It retains the notion that women cannot take up space in the public sphere, about who can lead, what qualities it takes to lead, which are mostly masculine. Because when you think of leadership in general, it does reflect characteristics of masculinity. Mm-hmm. And then there's this whole discussion of what are the qualities of women and men, which is another major reason why it's difficult for women to participate in politics, because of traditions and beliefs about the role of women in society. And I think this combined with things like family responsibilities or burden of care poses more challenges for women to occupy these kind of a space in politics. But in terms of why it's a problem, I would say the obvious is that 50% of our population is actually women, but laws and policies are made primarily by men. And I think especially during the pandemic, a lot of people are talking about the disproportionate impact on children and women, but it is a problem. And we cannot deny the fact that certain groups are disproportionately impacted. And without a representation of these marginalized communities or women in decision-making processes, these issues will continue to remain sidelined.
I'm sure some of the listeners might be wondering, does it actually really matter? After all, whether it's a man or a woman, you know, what matters is that they do their jobs well. But it's a lot more complex than that, isn't it? Because I remember when you spoke at Parliament Digital last year, you stressed the importance of looking at each and every policy through a gendered lens. You also talked about something called gender mainstreaming. Can you walk us through this a little bit?
It's a very valid argument that comes up when you speak about why women should be platformed in politics. Or when you speak about quotas, a lot of the times they put quotas against meritocracy. And I had to think a lot about that when I was first thinking about women's political participation as well. And I came across this one article that actually very nicely put how, like, that whole argument about how quotas are non-meritocratic is actually a myth to justify the privilege-based status quo that we already have. Because when you're talking about recruiting people in politics, merit and quotas are actually not mutually exclusive. But in fact, quotas open up politics to everybody, making it very essential for a meritocratic system. So that being said, and during Parliament Digital, I did speak about gender mainstreaming. And I think it's time that countries do take into consideration or give importance to this. But simply put, I think it's basically the concept of when you're planning, designing, implementing, or even monitoring after the implementation of policies, you actually integrate a gender perspective into each of this process. Basically, it's how you design a program or policy in a way that it benefits everyone in the community equally. But I think more than equality, you're looking at equity in this case, because you see how policies need to reach different people differently. I would take COVID-19 into perspective, right? Mm-hmm. We know that everybody's losing jobs. The economy is bad. A lot of people are getting retrenched and things like that. But studies have shown that women are more likely to drop out of workforce, and that would make them returning to workforce also more difficult. And this you would see as reasons such as having to look after family, because the burden of care on women during the pandemic is also significantly increased. So when you're looking at policies, when it comes to returning people to workforce, by applying a gender mainstreaming lens, you would also see what are the needs to ensure that women get to return to workforce. What are the specific needs that women need to return to workforce? And this can be things like better childcare policies or incentives for childcare. It can be things like, implementing policies to make sure that the environment is viable for women to return to workforce. So basically this, right, when you're looking at a very one-dimensional lens, you don't see how other groups may be affected due to other reasons.
On that note, we do need to go for a very quick break. After the break, we will be exploring what Malaysia could look like with a woman prime minister. We'll be back with more on What If Malaysia, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to What If Malaysia, an 8-episode mini-series where we examine what Malaysia could look like with certain progressive ideas, concepts and policies. On our first episode, we examine what if Malaysia has a woman prime minister. I'm Dashran Johan and alongside me is Melinda Ann of the 111 Initiative, an initiative that aims to ensure there is 50% female representation in Day One Rakyat. Okay, Melinda, let's now imagine what Malaysia could look like with a woman prime minister by discussing some of the benefits of having a woman at the head of government. Let's start with the economy and bread and butter issues. So can having a woman prime minister shape our country's economy positively? What have you observed from other countries?
I mean, when you told me of the title, I think it really got me thinking of that hypothetical women's prime minister. Mm-hmm. So obviously, whenever I refer to the women's prime minister in this conversation, I'm talking about the ideal candidate who's someone who's not in it for the name or power, but rather someone who understands gender politics or gender advocacy and is ready to work for the people who are tired of being ruled by old men who prioritize nothing but to remain in power. So that being said, I think when you talk about the economy and the market, I also tend to stay away from more technical conversations.
Right.
But oftentimes it's being reflected as male-dominated spaces. And I think it kind of thrives on productivity in labor and employment. But then even the idea of excluding women from the world of work and the labor market is so dangerous, right? Because they play a significant role in the labor market. But I think the most straightforward difference it would make is applying a gender lens to budgeting and the economy. Mm-hmm. So that would bring direct changes in structural policies that would encourage more women to return to the workforce, such as parental leave or, like I mentioned earlier, focus on childcare incentives so that women can actually balance work and the traditional notion of how they're supposed to look after the family. But I think there's also this idea, or actually it's actually proven by research, that women's political leadership actually is a direct influence on women's participation in the workforce in general. So it promotes gender balance in the workforce, and it also promotes more girls to go to school, because it's kind of shifting that narrative of where a woman's place is in, right?
Right.
So if you're looking at gender balance in the workforce and also girls going to school, more number of girls going to school, that can have a direct influence on the GDP growth. If you want like statistics to put things into perspective,
yes, please.
I think USAID did like a research and it said if 10 and more girls go to school, a country's GDP actually increases on average by 3%. And when women have the same amount of land as men, so they have greater autonomy, economic autonomy, yep, and ability to bring in like money, there is actually 10% increase in crop yields. So it's very obvious how women's political leadership can actually influence gender balance in many other aspects that have a direct influence on the economy. But that said, I think there has been trends of how women also tend to put higher budget allocations for health and education, which, mm-hmm, again, if it's anything we've learned from the pandemic, it's the importance of health, right?
Right.
And investment in healthcare and how that can actually have a major impact on the economy. So I think having ready-made provisions available or higher allocations for health and education, again, has a direct impact on the economy.
Another thing I've observed, at least in Malaysian politics, is that women seem to be more open to tackling issues in a more bipartisan manner. One example would be Hannah Yeo, who is from DAP or PH, and Azalina Othman, who's from UMNO or PN, working together on issues concerning child's rights, for example. Or you always see people like Nurul Izzah and Azalina Othman working on prison reform. What are your thoughts on this? Are women actually more likely to engage in bipartisan politics?
I don't know if you can make a generalization, but of course, this depends on one of the many different leadership styles that the individual is taking. However, I think the modern ideas of transformative leadership are apparently in line with qualities that women generally portray, like inclusiveness or open negotiation style. And I think that's where we're looking at trends where women across the world are more likely to work across bipartisan line. I think it gives me a lot of hope, and I'm talking about this because of the very recent engagement that YB Azalina and YB Hanna did. And it's not just bipartisan at that stage, it's tripartite, right? You're also involving civil society, which is great. It really gives us a hope to be able to put that confidence on the women MPs, when most of the men politicians now are just more busy on retaining power. So it's like a breath of fresh air. Honestly, I don't know what is the exact reason that makes women more likely to work towards bipartisan lines. But I think women in general take the approach of welfare for the well-being of people. They tend to put people's welfare first when you're thinking of policies and things like that. So when you're making policies, if you are not being individualistic, but you're actually being collectivist and you're thinking of the welfare of the greater good of your community, you're able to put your personal differences aside, unless you're in it for personal gains, right? If you're in it for personal gains, then you have no reason working across party lines, putting your differences aside. But I think women, especially those who are there to work towards the welfare of the communities, they are able to put that aside and work together. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether I'm able to retain power and all that. All that matters is the policies that I feel is important is being pushed with allies from the other side, regardless of their differences. And I'm able to work with them to get the policies across.
Right. You know, Melinda, you often hear about how politics is a man's world, you know, this that to be successful in politics, you need to be hard, you need to be stoic, you cannot show emotion. It's that kind of traditional masculine things. And that's why they say it's no place for a woman. What are your thoughts on this? I can see you rolling your eyes.
I think on Twitter, like when the whole Trump thing happened, right? A lot of people were talking about how, oh, they say women can't get into politics because they're very emotional. Look at how he's handling his
exactly.
loss. So like that's why I rolled my eyes. But I think in terms of this, right, realistically, when we're speaking, we do know that women are held to higher standards than men, whether in politics or workforce. So women are expected to work harder and be more assertive. That's where I think that whole like idea of being hard and stoic comes from. But that being said, I think you also have to see whether the political environment is viable in terms of safety and security, because there's a lot of like tendencies for workplace discrimination or even gender-based violence. This shouldn't be a determinant, obviously, but sadly, that's the world we live in. And I think as women, you just have to make yourself heard and you have to continue occupying spaces. I think I particularly adore YB Kasturi and how she ensures she's heard in parliament. Like when a racist remark is thrown at her, you know, she has to emphasize again and again on how it affects her and how it offends her and how it's sexist and racist. But I think as a woman, you have to make yourself heard in order to get your message across, because sadly, that's the kind of political environment we are in. I think same goes for YB Hanna. And I think when I met YB Azalina in person as well, you can see how she carries herself in a way that people have to take her seriously. Also, like I did mention earlier, that whole notion of how women are supposed to take care of the family, right? I think that's also that whole idea of how women will probably have to work harder every day because of that expectations that you have to meet in managing your family, but also running a country. I think with proper institutions and policies, you will not only be able to prove that you can be in a leadership position, but I think you can also pass on the message that for regular citizens like you and I, especially women, you people can't use your family to justify why you can't return to the workforce. It can have like a huge ripple effect for the larger society as well.
And also, our political scene seems to overflow with this toxic masculinity. You know, we see this in our parliamentary proceedings. You brought up racism thrown towards YB Kasturi Pato, crude humor, non-stop screaming at each other, and this obsession with power. And I'm thinking, perhaps politics could use a little bit more compassion kindness, you know, these genuine warm emotions that people usually say are, you know, associated with women or, you know, femininity. And maybe that's what we need. Maybe our politics could use a little bit of femininity.
Yep, of course. I mean, I agree with you. I think as Malaysians, we are just so tired watching power grabs, power politics. And it's just that you don't see regular citizens like you and I being prioritized. And it's not just you and I. There are also other marginalized communities that continue to be discriminated on a daily basis, on the basis of their sexual identity, on the basis of their nationality, legal status. It's just sad. And it shows how the government doesn't care. Because I think when you go back again, I think it's a very amazing perspective that someone spoke to me about. Mm-hmm. And it's about the role of the state. Primarily, the role of the state is looked at defense, security, economy, governance. But isn't the role of the state also to protect the welfare of the people in the country? Mm-hmm. But oftentimes, you don't see leaders or people in decision-making powers taking that approach. But I think what we saw Jacinda Ardern doing in that circumstance, and also with how she tackled COVID-19, was being inclusive and being including everybody, being down to earth, bridging that kind of a hierarchical gap. That is really a breath of fresh air. Because like I mentioned earlier during like our first part as well, obviously, leadership is seen very hierarchically because of how it is very masculine. It came up as a form of Western hegemonic masculinity. So, like you very rightly pointed out, how we definitely need to see a significant change in how we view leadership. That just because you're in power doesn't give you the right to not consider the welfare of the people, but that's the very reason why you're there. So we definitely need way more compassion than we are getting today, especially for the protection of marginalized communities.
You brought up COVID-19 earlier, right? Many experts have pointed to Taiwan and New Zealand as the best countries in the world when it comes to battling the COVID-19 crisis. Surprise, surprise, both of these countries have women at the head of governments. Surely this can't be a coincidence.
No, I did read that research as well, yeah, where it involved 194 countries, yeah, and they were able to trace commonalities. And most of it was the fact that they were able to lock down the country way ahead of other countries that are led by male leaders. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about early, I think it's early in terms of how many deaths they had. I think a lot of countries that are male-led, especially like ours as well, they wasted time in debating between economy and welfare, whereas these two countries were able to go into lockdown much earlier by just prioritizing welfare of people. But many argued that that was not the wisest decision considering the long-term impact on the economy. But that being said, our country is not doing great either now because we've not been able to successfully contain the pandemic. And because of power grabs and also very dirty politics, we've been seeing the pandemic being dragged on much longer than we actually anticipated. We didn't see this coming, but we saw it coming when we saw the whole like power play in the governments currently. But I think another thing that really stood out with how New Zealand specifically, they handled the pandemic was how they connected with the people. Jacinda Ardern actually bridged that gap and she actually had like a Facebook Live or something with their citizens. And like for us, we have like a larger gap between the state and the civil society and the people. Mm-hmm. And that was also because of the change in government. Also like the Norwegian like Prime Minister, she actually had like a separate event for children or something because she thought like children would have a more like impact or because of the pandemic, because they're stuck at home, they don't understand what's happening and all that.
When we look at some of the policies that we've been trying to push for over the past couple of decades in the country, the unresolved issues, what are some of the key differences we would be seeing in Malaysia right now if we have a woman prime minister?
Yeah, I think the women's groups have been pushing for a lot of issues and some of them are really long-standing. And I think, again, a hypothetical women's prime minister we're talking about, someone is ideal, someone who understands gender advocacy, right? So I would think they're able to really put a gender lens into issues and are able to create a greater accountability, put aside power play and, you know, retaining power and all of that, and actually look at how different groups are disproportionately impacted. And a lot of us are talking about the immediate impacts of COVID-19 because that's the issue at hand. And I think with that, some of the issues that have been coming up lately have been access to education and internet among children, who, because we are moving to remote learning, not everyone has access to this and no one's doing anything about it. I mean, there are some who are putting in more short-term initiatives, but I mean, long-term structural changes, nobody's talking about this. I think the major issue when it comes to women during the pandemic has been gender-based violence, right?
Right.
There have been so many conversations on how there's increased GBV among women, especially because they're trapped with abusers. But the government hasn't put in any machinery to address this. There's no policies, there's no resources allocated for this. I think the CSOs are doing way more than what we can see the government doing. Again, I think when we're talking about COVID-19, and then you're talking about the economy, right? There might be a chance that child marriage, we may see a rise in the number of child marriage, because many may see marriage as a solution to familial economic crisis and they marry off kids. And Malaysia has been really disappointing in how we've been handling the whole push for policies on child marriage. I don't understand why there's such a huge resistance. And honestly, if I were to have a women's prime minister, I would want them to push the issue of gender-based violence and child marriage the most. And also, like I mentioned earlier, other issues that impact marginalized communities and taking a more compassionate and considerate approach when you're dealing with access to protection and justice among marginalized communities. I think these are the key differences I would envision. Yeah.
Yeah. And for longest time, child marriage has always been an issue in Malaysia. But when did we see the biggest amount of focus and the biggest push for change is that when we had a woman as a deputy prime minister. Another mm-hmm. thing is also the sexual harassment bill, right? For 20 years, they've been trying to push for it. It almost came true again when there was a mm-hmm. woman deputy prime minister. So these things make a big difference, right?
It does. It really does. I think also because we had really progressive women ministers and deputy ministers during PH time, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, even in my personal work with the Malaysian Campaign for Equal Citizenship, we really thought the campaign was moving forward to ensure that women had equal access to pass on citizenship to their kids. And now, we don't know where the campaign's going to go because, people don't pay attention to these kind of issues. Also, we went into the lockdown, so people don't really pay attention mm-hmm. to these long-term issues. But like I said, when you're looking at policies, when you're looking at issues, you can't be very one-dimensional. You need to see how issues are intersectional with one another and how they are impacted, which is why this hypothetical women's prime minister that I'm talking about, I really wish is someone who understands gender dynamics and is able to work through these differences and is able to take an intersectional approach.
Definitely. And what are some of the changes we need to see in our current political system in Malaysia for us to achieve this vision of having a woman prime minister in Malaysia?
I think it's primarily how prime ministers are selected now, because I think the system now is that the winning party or coalition indirectly elects their prime minister, which means us voters actually don't get to choose who exactly becomes the prime minister. And we live in the clutches of patriarchy and sexism and racism, mm-hmm. among other forms of discrimination. So, of course, it makes it very much more difficult for a prime minister who is a woman, even more so if it's of a different race, if it's a minority, it's going to be very difficult to occupy spaces in political parties and to actually be nominated to take on the premiership in the current political climate. So I think that would be the major change that we would need to see in the political system in order to have a woman's prime minister. But I think, again, the whole tradition and belief of women's place, I think areas such as defense and security, they have such a masculine connotation to it. Also because I think, like I said, we've been ruled by men all this while. Also how media portrays defense and security areas, they often have masculine connotations. There's this whole idea of how welfare, education, women's rights are soft and weak, and defense and security are symbols of strength and are associated with men. But like I said earlier as well, it's not that case, right? Because education and healthcare, they have such a huge impact on the country as a whole. We're in the middle of a pandemic and we're in such deep trouble because of lack of investment in both these spaces. So I think as long as there are masculine attributes assigned to achieving standard, achieving strength, leadership, that's going to be very difficult as well for women to hold such high positions in a country. There needs to be like a huge radical shift in how we think. So I think if we're able to see a change, then it will be really good.
We've talked about the problems with having old men running the country. We've talked about the benefits that we could see if we have a proper and ideal woman at the helm of the country, right? But do you see this happening in Malaysia anytime soon? Do you think it's realistically possible for us to have a woman prime minister in the near future? And is Malaysia ready for a woman prime minister?
I don't know if I see it happening, but I want to see it happening. But it's difficult unless there is a multi-pronged change. Like I mentioned throughout our discussion, a change in the electoral system, a change in how our political parties run, a change in the resources available for women to run for political positions, and also whether the environment is made viable or not. So we're talking about the push of the sexual harassment bill and all that. So because we are, we have to escape the clutches of a society that's rooted in sexism and stereotypes. So I think we basically not only have to manage to occupy these positions, but we also have to challenge the association of these positions with masculinity. There's two monsters we're fighting. It's not only like systemic change, but it's also cultural beliefs that you have to like challenge. But whether we're ready or not, like I said, there is a strong need. Because during the MCO and during COVID-19 in general in Malaysia, I think we're tired of looking at the incompetence in governance. We're tired of the lack of accountability. Every day, stories are surfacing on social media of how there's lack of accountability. And just power grabs in general that brought us into this deep mess that we are in today. And I don't see our current governance tackling bread and butter issues or issues of welfare and well-being of people in the country. So there is a strong need for a change in the way we are being governed. And I think that with this hypothetical women's prime minister, I'm going to manifest all my energy into this discussion we're having today, that we truly see this happening, that we have someone who's able to tackle policies that address the needs of marginalized communities and who take an intersectional approach. So we are in a much better place than we are today.
I'm right there with you, Melinda. Fingers crossed we do get a woman prime minister who understands the importance of looking at things through a gendered prism, who understands gender advocacy. On that note, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That was Melinda Ann of the 111 Initiative, exploring the question, what if Malaysia has a woman prime minister? And that pretty much wraps up the first episode of What If Malaysia, an 8-episode miniseries where we explore what Malaysia could look like with certain progressive ideas, concepts and policies. So if you missed any part of this conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.myo. You can even subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. Just search for BFM, Live and Learn. Once again, I'm Darshan Johan, and you've been listening to What If Malaysia on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.